in times of real trouble, elected officials rise to the occasion.
The only way to build a thriving economy is to set and enforce firm rules of the world.
They did not do enough. There was not a whole lot of stimulus of actual infrastructure.
Is hyperinflation a successful outcome of what they're trying to do?
Just realize that these people don't know what's going on.
The strong rights theory we turn to today is libertarianism.
You don't have to use fiscal stimulus or monetary stimulus. There is a third way.
We don't know how other people should live, and you cannot organize a society.
The case for the free market, and the case for liberty, and the case against statism.
Welcome, everybody, to the Christian Smallwood Show. This is October 28th, 2013, and I'm taking on a topic, or a question, rather, of is the state unnecessary today? So we have this, you know, this government in the United States, and there's a lot of, you know, battling back and forth of trying to, you know, limit its size or, you know, increase its size. And the question comes out often is it, you know, in joking, is it even necessary, right? And people, you know, dismiss that. They think it's an extremist position. And I want to bring it back to the table and just kind of refresh our minds and actually consider it and actually put it on the table. And I'm going to hopefully give some reasons of incentives to at least open your mind to it. And I think they're pretty convincing. And if you disagree, then that's fine, but at least open your mind to it and not dismiss it. So first off, why not just limited government? So in a minarchist perspective, why not just try your hardest to take some power away, you know, slowly, so we can have a more controllable and not an overpowering system? Well, I was in that camp. We battled for it. We had all these campaigns, and tons of money going into it every year about these different think tanks and all of this trying to limit the size of government. And the problem with that is you're asking the institution you don't want to that's the problem to limit itself. It's like asking an alcoholic to slowly take away their drinking. It doesn't work. They either have to commit to stopping. If I told an alcoholic, can you please just over the last month, your goal shouldn't be to stop drinking alcohol. It should be just to cut your alcohol consumption in half and then stop there. Well, you all know what would happen, right? Even if they did, say they did, an alcoholic did stop, and they say they drank every night heavily, and then they by the next 2 months, they started drinking every other night heavily. Even if they got to that point, we know at some point that addiction is still there. So it is going to come back. It's inherent in this in the corruption and addiction. And that's the same thing with the state. I mean, the power is corrupting, and it's addictive. And when a state has, the state in itself, that is the only mechanism that it has, is power. There's no other mechanism. It can't create anything, obviously. All of its money comes from taxation, borrowing, or inflation. So there's no other source of success besides power. That's the only way they can do anything to you. And I'll get into that in a little bit. But so that is why I've kind of left the limited government standpoint about 2 years ago, because it's kind of like you're chasing a unicorn in a sense. It's never going to happen. And if it does happen, it's not going to last very long. So my idea is you have to go to somewhere that at least has a consistent background and can be convincing to people, and it actually can make change on the long run of human progress. So when I talk about this, some empirical arguments, right, that come up against anarchy are, you know, the economy, the poor people, and how would we defend ourselves? So first off, at the economy, if you're really questioning about why we need the government, why the government shouldn't be in the economy, you really haven't watched too much of our history in the last 200 years, or you're just a Keynesian drone, which I can completely understand that you're going to follow someone who believes that war is profitable and actually increases wealth. Basically, if I dug a ditch and filled it back in, that's growing the economy and increasing our wealth. That was basically Keynesianism 101. So as far as the economy goes, a quick empirical understanding is the Federal Reserve was created in 1913 We were still in the gold standard then. So many of you, if you guys don't know, we as of 1971, the United States dollar is not backed by anything. Many people still believe that the dollar is backed by gold. It's not. In 1971, Nixon got rid of that. So we are completely off the gold standard now. But in 1913, we started the Federal Reserve. And that was the start of severe inconsistency and just great fluctuation in economic progress. From 1789 to 1913, the United States took a little over 120 years to grow as the superpower of the world. It took them a century. There have been countries that have existed for millennia, and they still are not even close. And I mean, and then the one difference is, I mean, we had at least an idea of laissez-faire economics and free markets. But in 1913, and during that decade of the 19th century, we had very few depressions. And if we did, they were very small and were caused still by an influx of credit. Just not by the Federal Reserve, not by an overwhelming central bank, but other banking systems in the United States that basically acted as a central bank in the private sector. But in 1913, the central bank came in as the Federal Reserve, and they started manipulating the currency, they started manipulating the interest rates, and that is the backbone of an economy, right? The money. Once if you can control the money supply, you control everything. So they controlled that, and their whole idea, their original charter was to increase and decrease the money supply that way, in a sense that we wouldn't, that if there was a depression coming, we could decrease the money supply or increase it to avoid those depressions. So it would basically just smooth over the economy. And what have we seen? The Great Depression occurred 16 years after its founding because of the Federal Reserve. We saw the stagflation of the 1970s, and most recently, the Great Recession. All disastrous time periods under the Federal Reserve. So obviously, I mean, I'm naming three big ones, but obviously it's been a complete failure in its original charter, and there's no such thing as deflating the currency anymore. I mean, that was all they do is they inflate the currency and increase the money supply when it's bad. An increase it a little less when times are good, but they increase it even more when times are bad. So it's only increasing. There's no end in sight as far as inflation goes. There's no deflation whatsoever because the economy is addicted to that influx. And if they did deflate, we would have a severe deep recession right now. So obviously the economy cannot be a real understanding because the economy isn't a system, right? The economy, if you think about it, and you have to be reasonable here and not use your middle school history books, the economy is simply people. It's people interacting. The economy would not exist if people didn't exist. So we are the economy. There is no system that needs to be fixed. We are the economy. And there is no planner that can fix that. And that is all-knowing to know every single problem and every distribution and every price that should be set in an economy. The second rebuttal I often hear is, what about the poor? The poor would suffer greatly in their anarchist system. Again, you have to look at the empirical evidence. In 1789, when the Constitution was ratified, the poverty level was 95%. So 95% of the entire population were below the poverty level. And what happened to that level? Well, from that point until the 1970s, the poverty rate went down tremendously. By the 1960s, it was flirting with the teens. It was around 25 to 18%. It dropped drastically in that time period. Over a century, it dropped that far. And what has happened since? And now when I say the 1960s, you might be wondering why I'm just stopping there. Well, the 1960s is when LBJ started the Great Society program, which is where we've grown, you know, the welfare state, Social Security, and all of these great welfare programs. And what has happened to the poverty level? Well, it is virtually stagnated. It has not gone down significantly. It's went down roughly 4% since the 60s till today. If it was the other way around, and we had the government involved in the poor people's lives, from 1789 till 1960, and it dropped from 95 to 20 to 18, whatever, and then when we stopped all funding, and it only went down like 4% in 50 years, you know, there'd be an outrage. So the welfare state is a complete joke as a success of the state. It is an utter failure, and it's been proven to lock people in poverty otherwise than they would. I mean, we've spent $5 trillion in the last 2 years on the welfare state, or in the last decade. And people are still poor. They're poorer than they were 10 years ago. So, I mean, all this money that we've used, the reason is because all of that money isn't going directly to the poor, like it does in private charity. Only roughly 10% of all money given for welfare programs and all the funding goes directly to poor people. It goes to processing. It goes to the bulk and waste in Washington. Compared to what? The 80 to 90% direct connection of the money that comes from donations from charities, private charities to the poor. There's a fundamental and humongous gap there that could be fixed fairly easily if we eliminated the welfare state. So the poverty of the poor people are not saved by the state. They are completely kept in poverty and stuck in that kind of system. And the last one I always get, and this is I can at least sympathize with this, and that is defense, right? It's the old, the government protects us if who's over the other side of those mountains, right? It's that idea of being safe. Well, I mean, if you want an idea of being safe, as a government being the ones who keep you safe, let me just give you a quick statistic. In the last century, 200 million, think about that, 200 million civilians have been killed by their own governments in the last century. If you just think about that, 200 million people. And that doesn't include war that the state starts. This is only the state killing its own people in the last century. Imagine how many people that is. You can't even comprehend that. And my main point, this is one of my main points, at least for considering, if you're just blowing me off, if you at least can consider the idea that we could save 200 million, and if you include war, it's closer to a quarter of a trillion or a billion people. If we could save that many lives by abolishing the state, would it not be at least a noble duty to at least attempt to think about it? Is it not noble to at least question the possibility of being able to save that many people's lives? I think so. I think that's one of the main arguments for it. That's a massive amount of people. And if we can save them, it's at least, you should at least attempt to open your mind a little bit, read a little bit if you're on the fence or you're completely shutting me off right now. At least think about it. If you're someone who believes that we should help one another and be charitable and be benevolent to others, at least you have to at least consider it. To think that you could save that many people's lives by simply abolishing one institution. It's incredible. Now, I know these empirical arguments, just giving you statistics, isn't really a convincing argument, which I could agree with. I mean, you could always find statistics that prove another point. There's an infinite amount of evidence in the world, and it can be used for any single thing. But compared to the idea of how many people have been killed, I mean, you're not going to find another institution that's killed that many people ever, not even close. But I understand that in itself, empirical arguments aren't really the most convincing thing. What is theory, right? Logical thinking. Now, I'm going to give you my quick understanding and belief of what the state actually is, and then I'm going to give you a far better understanding of what the state actually is. I'm going to read a portion of an article. But real quickly, if you think about it logically and just ask, what is the government? What is it? If it doesn't defend us, if it just starts wars for power, and it kills its own people more than any other institution in the entire human nature. So it doesn't defend us. It doesn't help the poor. And it does not keep us economically successful. What is it? Well, simply put, I mean, this is not refutable. This is what the state is. Now, you might have good views about it, but this is what the state is down to its core. It is simply a group of people in a specified area that we call countries that claim the right to enact actions on other human beings and not be credible for it. They have a monopoly on the use of force. They can kill you, they can steal from you, and it's perfectly legal. There's simply a group of people that deem that they can do that and you can't. That's all the state is. And it's the only institution that is allowed to use force. In your own life, do you use force? If someone doesn't give you, you know, if someone doesn't lower their price for, you know, a game you want or a car or whatever it may be, do you shoot him and take the car because it's, you know, you want it? No. Because you understand that the initiation of force is wrong. If you think about it, that is what the state is. It is simply a group of people. There is no abstract institution. Just because they live in shiny buildings does not mean that they're better than us. There are a group of people that live above the law. And they have a monopoly on what that law means. They can deem that if you are doing something that affects no one else, such as drug consumption or whatever it may be, that they can come into your house and arrest you and then put you in a box, a cement box that you can be raped in, right? In prisons. Because you were doing something that wasn't affecting anyone else, but that they deem as morally wrong. Is that right at all? Is that moral? Is it moral to use force to enact your view of morality? Of course not. Now, I want to read here a far better description of what the state actually is here. And I'm taking an excerpt of Murray Rothbard's essay, The Anatomy of the State. Now, the heading of this section is simply what the state is. Now, I'm going to read this to you, and I want you to really think about what the state actually is. And if it's at least worthwhile to contemplate if there is a possibility of getting rid of it. And I quote, "Man is born naked into the world, and needing to use his mind to learn how to make the resources given to him by nature, and transform them into shapes and forms and places where the resources can be used for the satisfaction of his wants and the advancement of his standard of living. The only way by which man can do this is by the use of his mind and energy to transform resources and to exchange the products of these products for products created by others. Man has found that through the process of voluntary mutual exchange, that productivity and hence the living standards of all participants in the exchange may increase enormously. The only natural course for man to survive and to attain wealth, therefore, is by using his mind and energy to engage in the production and exchange process. He does this first by finding natural resources and then by transforming them to make them into his individual property, and then by exchanging this property for the similarly obtained property of others. The social path dictated by the requirements of man's nature, therefore, is the path of property rights and the free market of gift or exchange of such rights. Through this path, men have learned how to avoid the jungle of methods of fighting over scarce resources so that A can only acquire them at expense of B, and instead to multiply those resources enormously in peaceful and harmonious production and exchange. The great German sociologist Franz Oppenheimer pointed out that there are two mutually exclusive ways of acquiring wealth. One, the above way of production and exchange, he calls the economic means. The other way is simpler in that it does not require productivity. It is the way of seizure of another's goods and services by the use of force and violence. This is the method of one-sided confiscation, of theft of the property of others. This is the method which Oppenheimer termed the political means to wealth. It should be clear that the peaceful use of reason and energy in production is the natural path for man, the means for his survival and prosperity on this earth. It should be equally clear that the coercive, exploitative means is contrary to natural law. It is parasitic, for instead of adding production, it subtracts from it. The political means siphons production off to the parasitic and destructive individual or group, and this siphoning not only subtracts from the number of producing, but also lowers the producer's incentive to produce beyond his own subsistence. In the long run, the robber destroys his own subsistence by dwindling and eliminating the source of his own supply. But not only that, even in the short run, the predator is acting contrary to his own true nature as a man. We are now in a position to answer more fully the question, what is the state? The state, in the words of Oppenheimer, is the organization of the political means. It is the systemization of the predatory process over a given territory. For crime, at best, is sporadic and uncertain. The parasitism is immoral, and the coercive, parasitic lifeline may be cut off at any time by the resistance of its victims. The state provides a legal, orderly, and systematic channel for the predation of private property. It renders certain, secure, and relatively peaceful the lifeline of the parasitic caste in society. Since production must always precede predation, the free market is anterior to the state. The state has never been created by a, quote, social contract. It has always been born in conquest and exploitation. The classic paradigm was the conquering tribe pausing in its time-honored method of looting and murdering a conquered tribe to realize that the time span of plunder would be longer and more secure and the situation more pleasant if the conquered tribe were allowed to live and produce, with the conquerors settling among them as rulers, exacting a steady annual tribute. One method of the birth of the state may be illustrated as follows. In the hills of southern Ruritania, a bandit group manages to obtain physical control over a territory, and finally the bandit chieftain proclaims himself king of the sovereign and independent government of South Ruritania. And if he and his men have the force to maintain this rule for a while, lo and behold, a new state has joined the family of nations, and the former bandit leaders have been transformed into the lawfully nobility of the realm. That is the essence of the state. If you really think about it, and if you don't mind, can you just think about it for open your mind for 1 second to actually think of that, if that is really what the state is? Because there's really no getting around that. You can believe that is the correct way, and that is the extent of the human mind. That the best we can do is have people rule us and steal our production, which is the last institution that is allowed that consists of pure slavery. It is not hard to understand why they would do this. They get far more profit from letting us believe that we're free and letting us choose our job and letting us associate where we want to, because we will be more profitable. We will enjoy what we're doing. It's far more effective, and thus they will get far more wealth. The question is that the extent of our human capacity? Is the human race just deemed for slavery? Is that the farthest we can go? I don't believe so. I believe that the human race, the capacity of the human mind, can far exceed the primal institution of slavery. And that one day we can break free as long as we do it in a peaceful, non-aggressive, and voluntary manner. And if we can do that, if we can slowly prove one mind after another that they are meant to be free, and that they can rule themselves, and we can create institutions that can protect us, help the poor, and grow the economy without using force. If we can make that little of an impact and keep pushing day by day to change people's minds a little bit towards reason and understanding that they are free, we can finally make some progress and turn the tables a little bit at a time towards a free society. Okay, guys, that is it. That is my case for a free society and why the state is unnecessary. I hope you enjoyed it. I will be back tomorrow. Bye for now.